Siyanibingelela maqhawe sinifisela inkonzo ende.
And that message we've just heard, a snitch of, is on the way out of the solar system. In 1977, two spacecraft were launched on trajectories that would take them out of the solar system. Of course, that was not their objective at the time. These stated targets were to fly by first Jupiter and then Saturn. Called Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, they were launched atop Titan 3E Centaur rockets from Cape Canaveral. A Voyager 1 passed Jupiter on 1979 March the 5th, followed by Voyager 2 on July the 9th. With Jupiter in the rearview mirror, the two craft coasted towards Saturn. On 1980, November the 12th, Voyager 1 passed Saturn.
Mystifying man since the dawn of history, Saturn bears the name of the mythological god of the harvest, who reigned in the Golden Age. Traveling at more than 55,000 miles per hour, Voyager 1 arrived in November of 1980, only 12 miles off course after an interplanetary journey of more than a billion miles. Voyager's instruments found Saturn's atmosphere to be a cold ball of hydrogen and helium gases, racked by huge whirling storms and whipped by winds of up to 1,100 miles per hour. Saturn's magnificent rings, thought to have been the result of collisions between earlier moons and asteroids, consist of thousands of particles, swirling pieces of rock and ice, streaked like the grooves in a phonograph record. Voyager atmospheric scientist Dr. Andrew Ingersoll.
What Voyager discovered was the incredible structure in the rings. Saturn's rings are really composed of countless numbers of particles, ranging from the size of dust and perhaps larger particles, the size of houses. These particles are constantly bumping into each other. These grooves are there because the rings are constantly being disturbed by satellites orbiting in with the smaller ring particles themselves.
As the Voyagers swept by, sunlight penetrated, backlighting and brilliantly illuminating the splendor of the rings, like the spokes of a gigantic Catherine wheel. Voyager 1 flew within 2,500 miles of the surface of Saturn's largest moon, Titan. One of only three moons in the solar system known to have an atmosphere, Titan may help unlock secrets to the origins of life. Voyager project scientist Dr. Edward Stone.
Certainly one of the more exciting discoveries at Saturn was the atmosphere of Titan. It's an atmosphere which is mainly nitrogen like that here on Earth, but which contains methane, so that the photochemistry going on there today may resemble very strongly that which occurred here on Earth billions of years ago before life evolved.
By swinging around Saturn, after a close-up view of Titan, Voyager 1 was propelled out of the plane of the solar system and is now traveling toward interstellar space.
The gravitational field of Saturn deflected Voyager 1 northwards out of the ecliptic plane, never to pass another planet. With Voyager 1's science objectives at Saturn achieved, mission managers decided to send Voyager 2 on a different path through the Saturnian system. This allowed Voyager 2 to remain in the plane of the ecliptic and so head out to Uranus. 8.5 years after launch, on 1986 January the 24th, Voyager 2 encountered Uranus and its rings and moons.
First detected in 1781 by English astronomer Sir William Herschel, Uranus, in Greek mythology, is the name for the heavens. 5 years and almost a billion miles after leaving Saturn, Voyager 2 reached Uranus in January of 1986. Like all the other planets, Uranus spins like a top, but tipped over on its side. Strangely tilted and off-center, Uranus's magnetic field extends in a bizarre corkscrew tail millions of miles into space. Its magnetic poles are also wildly askew. Voyager 2 discovered two new rings. Dark, narrow, thin bands of ice, rock, and dust with particles the size of a fist. Although Voyager 2 discovered 10 new Uranian moons, the most eagerly anticipated event was the close encounter with Miranda, one of the most bizarre moons in our solar system. Close-ups of Miranda revealed a strange and wondrous landscape, including a canyon 12 miles deep. Miranda may have collided with another moon, shattered, and then by the force of its own gravity, slowly reassembled itself into this chunk of rock and ice. These digitized photographs are a silent testament to the violent origins of our solar system.
Last week, after 50 years in the position, Ed Stone has retired as Voyager Project scientist. I first met Ed Stone in 1980 at Kona on the main island of Hawaii. In later years, I re-met him in Sydney and here in Melbourne. He became a good friend of the space show, always generously allowing me to record his talks and making time for interviews.
Good evening, Ed. Welcome to the space show.
Glad to be here.
Well, Ed, what got you started in working in planetary exploration?
I started in planetary exploration back in 1972 when I was when I became the project scientist, the chief scientist for the Voyager mission, which, of course, is the mission that flew by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune during the late 70s and through the 1980s.
And you've been working with NASA ever since?
I've actually been working with NASA since about 1961 or 62. I did my first experiment in space in 1961, studying the Earth's magnetic field, and that was the link to the other planets, was studying their magnetic fields.
And as a result of your long-standing association with this planetary exploration, you've had a rather unique honor of having an asteroid named after you. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, this is an asteroid which fortunately is not an Earth-crossing asteroid, so we don't have to worry about an impact with Earth. But it's an asteroid which is out in the asteroid belt in a somewhat inclined plane, and certainly it's quite an honor to have an asteroid named after oneself. So I think it's just an indication, I think, that the interest there is in planetary exploration in the public at large, and the sense of the future that space provides for so many people.
Well, Ed, during the 1960s, there were lots and lots of missions to the moon and the planets, and then in the 1970s, 80s, and into the early 90s, they began to dribble out, because basically you priced yourself out of the market, didn't you?
I think it really, the way I like to look at it is we're now in the third era of planetary exploration. During the first era, the technical challenge was just getting there. And that was the 1960s, where we were just learning how to navigate, how to build spacecraft that could last long enough. And what we learned was not central to the accomplishment. Having shown we could get there, then the engineering challenge became finding out what was out there. And that required very large missions with many instruments, since we had no idea what was out there. And that led to missions like Voyager and Galileo and Cassini. Having those missions, which have now told us what's out there, the next phase, the next engineering challenge, is one of getting there often and getting back. And since our budget is not going to go up a factor of 10, so we can go there 10 times more often, what has to happen if we want to go 10 times more often is to reduce the cost by a factor of 10. And that's essentially what we're doing with this new era. We are launching a mission in October, November, December, January, February, and March. But those missions are all much smaller and much lower cost. I see beyond this current generation, where the costs are typically in the $100 to $200 million class, that the next, perhaps 10 years from now, we will have missions which cost $10 or $20 million each and could be launched piggyback for $1 million per launch. That will further open up the opportunity for exploring space to a much wider group of individuals.
How will you achieve that?
modern technology, which we're currently investing in, should allow us to reduce the spacecraft avionics first to a set of boards, then to a set of chips, and perhaps eventually to a single chip. It's like buying a PC. You buy the chip, and that's your spacecraft. You bolt it onto whatever you want to send there, and go.
That's pretty amazing, and look, that's pretty exciting too, because we used to wait, 5 years between missions, and now we're almost back into those heady days when we were, almost find out about them after they've been launched.
Well, in fact, we've never launched one mission a month, even back in the early days. So this is not just going back to the early days. This is doing even better than the early days.
Thank you for joining us today on the Space Show, Ed.
Thank you.
Priya Dumelisa Marena.
And that was one of many greetings that were on board the Voyager spacecraft. The gravity of Uranus deflected Voyager 2 and directed it towards Neptune. The 12-year-old craft passed within 5,000 kilometres of Neptune's North Pole on 1989, August the 24th. Shortly thereafter, the craft passed Neptune's moon Triton. Since then, both Voyagers have passed through the Kuiper Belt of asteroids and dwarf planets and are now operating in interstellar space. They are controlled by the Canberra Deep Space Complex in Tidbinbilla. Every scientific space mission has a project scientist, whose role is to oversee the scientists who have instruments aboard the craft. The number of scientists involved with Voyager has varied over the years, but at the time of the 1986 Uranus encounter, there were 100 officially listed. Not only has the project scientist got to settle the competing demands of the scientist during the mission, this person has to guide the development of the mission during the initial planning and consultation. Well, Ed Stone accepted that role in 1972, yes, 50 years ago. And at that time, Voyager was little more than a few overhead projector diagrams. Well, let's take a listen to some comments about Ed Stone as the leader of the project.
For 7 years we'd been preparing, and suddenly, for a period of several months, we were overwhelmed with a flood of discoveries, one after the other, many every day. One of the challenges we had in planning, because all this has to be pre-planned, and all has to be loaded onto the spacecraft and then executed automatically. What do we look at? When? What do we observe at what time?
Ed Stone was, and remains, the Voyager project scientist. The only person ever to hold the position. It has proven to be a plum assignment. But Stone, a Caltech professor of physics, had to be convinced to take the job.
And eventually I realized that this was really an opportunity of a lifetime because we were going on a journey of discovery.
Stone knew that taking the position would mean coping with sizable squabbles among a science team numbering over 200. But his low-key temperament made him an excellent choice for reaching consensus when faced with competing interests.
We would occasionally have conflicts that seemed irresolvable. We would prepare a presentation for the project science group saying, these are the alternatives and we have to choose one or some combination of two of them. Dr. Stone, at that point, would hear from each of the teams what their opinions was, and then he'd say, okay, this is the way we're going to do it, and that's the way we did it.
I think the point is that, we don't want to work the problem here. If there are some problems, there's an outside forum to do it.
Sure.
It was a great training ground for learning how to handle conflicting science requirements. There's a phrase that shows up in discussing science conflicts. My science is better than your science. And if that's your only argument, you're not going to win. You've got to convince the other guys that you've got a point that your science is worth doing and it's worth trying to accommodate it. And that's what Ed was very good at.
So, with Ed Stone now retired, and we wish him well in that retirement, Linda Spilker takes over as Voyager project scientist. Now, she was previously the Cassini project scientist, and that craft was launched in 1997 and orbited Saturn from 2004 until 2017. Well, she recently was asked to read some poetry. As part of the poetry reading, she had to describe this Orpheus in Plain Daylight is the name of the poem. It's written by Jessica Ray Bergamino, and as we said, it's going to be read by Linda Spilker. And it's about the Voyager 1 photo of the solar system. And Linda was part of the mission team that took that famous photo.
My name is Linda Spilker. I'm a planetary scientist and Cassini project scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Today, I'm reading a poem entitled, After Taking the Family Portrait of the Solar System, Voyager 1 Understands Herself as Orpheus in Plain Daylight, by Jessica Ray Bergamino. Valentine's Day, 1990. Past Pluto, I turn to watch the pale thrill of Earth spinning on without me. We both knew I could never return. She was already warring cold, beginning, even then, to melt. But what's true about leaving is true about looking back. Both require doubt for poignancy. And if I'm honest, we all know I turned because she called. I'd always been a mirror for her will. So this is how I measure distance, not in the leaving, but in being left, in the absence of touch. The billions, in small orbits strung upon small orbits, spinning to some celestine harmony we were never meant to count. I sent all I could across the distance, thrills of zeros and ones dimming to data on an astronomer's desk. How she saw herself then, fragrant, green, lit by the smear of sun, a bright crescent hung beside Venus's flame, both of them pocked by longing. She thought she was the center of the universe once, and how close she was. Straddled by fortune while Neptune and Uranus clung to the dark edges of sight. So, yes, I turned. Because who doesn't deserve to see ourselves in the ghost of what loves us? And she sang in code to celebrate, programming my eyes to close and never open, making sure my last long gaze was her blue face becoming its own reflection. How silly I was to call this a love letter. Somewhere, Mercury is retrograde.
And that was Linda Spilker reading Jessica Ray Bergamino's poem Orpheus in Plain Daylight about the famous Voyager 1 photo of the solar system. Well, Mark Hastings in 2010 recorded this item, which is called Those Distant Stars. And the background is a recording of Jupiter's plasma waves by the Voyager spacecraft.
I can see them now. I can feel their pull. I can understand their language. I can hear the voice of the eventual. Across a vast auditorium of light, masquerading as a sea of stars, I hear a lone voice, just as enticing as finding life on Mars. A voice that can only be heard by listening with your internal ear to the frequency of the enlightened, that which lies in wait for us all to revere. Epics have been written and ingrained with this voice of distant origin. Poems and stories, all inflamed with the name and the face of our celestial twin. Those distant stars, those first emanations of light, life, hope, and divinity, that their influence will live forever. They will forever live with anonymity. The voice of those distant stars that guide, provide, and remind us of our way travels the cosmological colosseum instantly and finds its listener without delay. Its message is a revelation. Its permeating meaning needs no translation. The voice of all voices, the true interpretation of every constellation, gives inspiration, hope, and truth equal to the magnitude of new life and rebirth. To anyone willing to listen in every galaxy, dimension, and planet like that of Earth. To me, this voice has been whispering its verse long before I was born. This voice has been there to greet all life since creation's first spawn. To me, this voice is the voice of a laureate, a maestro, a poet of every sphere. However, what this same voice would sound like to you, I cannot volunteer. To me, this voice is the voice of every male, female, child and offspring. The resonance of every instrument, the vibration of every string. The next time you're looking up in the night sky, searching the heavens for an answer, close your eyes, listen to the voice of those distant stars, and bring forth what they infer.
Now, the music we're listening to at the moment is on its way out of the solar system. It's on the Voyager interstellar record. And it's the Cranes in Their Nest, performed by Koro Yamaguchi. And we're playing it because, well, tonight we had a look at the Voyager spacecraft. And at least one of the two Japanese CubeSats launched on the Artemis 1 mission is working. On next week's The Space Show, we're going to be looking at Apollo 17, 50th anniversary of Apollo 17.